the light can ease from ourselves, though, indeed, there is that mysterious red glow. It is the light of God, of faith, of truth, which reaches us but goes no further. The higher we go, the brighter it becomes, till at length it is all in all. In hell there is no light either from faith or the individuals there. The real light by which we perceive things is within ourselves. The light you see I hardly realize, it is more comparable to the other effects of the landscape than light by which we can perceive. We seated ourselves on the soft grass under an oak tree, and below us I could see palms and tropical birds mingling with the ordinary English scenery. "Tell me what happened," I asked, after the visions had sorted themselves out as you told me they did in your letter. H.J.L. On either side the street of visions stretched as far as I could see, impinging on the landscape, which nevertheless I began to perceive again. Suddenly my teacher and guide stood beside me. "Come with me," he said, and led me clean through one of my visions into the country beyond. How to explain exactly what happened to my visions, I know not, but though they always haunt me, are with me even at the present moment, though unseen by you, yet they gradually fell into the background as it were. We walked across the fields and down the slope of a hill, and as we did so, I saw the roof of a splendid building. "What is that?" I asked. "The school to which you are going." "Apostrophe school. I'm not a child," I cried. "Indeed you are, an absolute child in matters of faith. Look how small you are." As he spoke I realized that he had become tall, but could not realize that I was small. We now stood before the portals of the building, surely the most magnificent and beautiful school which was ever conceived. Soon I was taken into a classroom, for so I must needs call it, for lack of a better name, and saw a number of boys. Boys. No, they were men, but strangely immature, though they looked like little miniature adults. "Gone west," then I saw their master or instructor. What a difference! Not merely was he a well-grown man, but he seemed to be made of light, light which filled the whole classroom with a bright, soft glow. The bodies of the other boys looked grey, though some were brighter than the others, and mine, I discovered, was the darkest of them all. Next moment I looked round for my guide, but he was gone. But the master took me quietly by the hand and set me in a seat. Then began the most wonderful lesson I have ever witnessed. His methods were entirely different to those of the ordinary schoolmaster. He seemed to draw the knowledge out of the boys rather than attempt to tell them anything. Most of the questions were quite unintelligible to me, though the others seemed to understand them quite well. His method consisted in asking cleverly arranged questions, and the answer to each led on to the next question. After a while he turned to me and said, "Would you like to ask me any questions?" "How is it," I asked, "that everything looks so solid here, and, above all, how is it I have a body? I thought I was a spirit." He. "What do all human beings consist of?" H. J. L. "Body and soul." He. "How would a scientist define these?" H. J. L. "Matter and force." He. "Good. What happens to the matter when you die? Is it destroyed?" H. J. L. "Matter can't be destroyed. It merely changes its form. My body will rot and become earth, and plants will grow out of it." He. "What of the force which made that body act?" H.J.L. "It has come here. It is the spirit. It, too, cannot perish." He. "Neither the matter nor the force perish. Yet is the body on the earth the same as when you lived?" H.J.L. Number. He. "What makes it different? If you were to look at it now, wherein would it chiefly differ?" H.J.L. "Well, it would be losing its old shape. Its form would be different." He. "The form would have gone. If neither the matter nor the force perish, what happens to the form? Can that perish?" H.J.L. "I do not see why not." He. "What of the form of the thoughts which haunt you? Their form has not perished. Why, then, should your form perish if theirs remains?" H.J.L. "Yes, but I still exist who thought those forms, so someone must have thought of me before I existed if I am like my thoughts. For I thought of them, and so they came into existence." He. Precisely. Someone must have thought of you. That person is God. He created you by thought, and so, too, you create things by thought. What lessons have you learnt? H. J. L. That form, like matter and force, does not perish. Secondly, that, as God created me by thinking of me, so I create forms by thinking of them. He. And what answer can you deduce to your questions from these facts? H. J. L. I suppose all that I see are forms, and being a form myself, they seem as solid as myself. But why do I seem solid? He. How could you seem otherwise? There is no matter here. H. J. L. If I went back to the earth, as I am, should I then appear to myself less substantial? He. Would you thereby become matter? H. J. L. No. You mean unless one becomes matter oneself, one would only seem form and force, not matter. He. If a light is placed in the midst of a cloud of smoke, what would you see? H. J. L. Why, of course, a light shining, through perhaps dimly, through smoke. Gone west, he. What is a flame? H. J. L. Force. He. Nothing more? H. J. L. It of course has a form. He. What is the smoke? H. J. L. Matter and form. He. Does this not answer your question? H. J. L. You mean I should see the spirit form shining through the material form as a candle does through smoke or fog? He. Yes. H. J. L. Having left matter behind, shall I ultimately also leave behind form? As I spoke these words, a terrible stillness seemed to fill the room. All the other boys leant forward expectantly. He. You have asked a question which I at any rate cannot fully answer. But this I can tell you, that we do leave behind the present form on rising to the next realm. What happens none of us here knows. We cannot see beyond the wall of fire any more than mortal eyes can penetrate the veil of death. The great messengers may know, but we who do but come from the highest divisions of this realm know not. You still wish to ask a question? H. J. L. We who are created by God look to Him for help and consider Him responsible for our well-being. Are we also responsible for the forms we create? Again the silence that could be felt brooded over the room. He. You ask wise questions, though so young. What happened to you after you had spoken a while with your guide? H. J. L. I told him of the hideous nightmare which had seized me, and how it sorted itself into order when I prayed. He. Does this not answer your question in part? Did not your thoughts claim you? H. J. L. I bowed my head in shame and sat silent. He. But your question means more than that. Speak on. H. J. L. But my thoughts cannot create fresh thoughts, as I can. He. Directly no, but what of indirectly? H. J. L. How can they even indirectly? He. In the material world an evil act is done. Are there none who copy that evil act? H. J. L. That is so, of course. But surely things are different here? He. Tell him the answer to that. One of the boys then spoke as follows: Nothing exists on earth which has not its counterpart here. We see this in the trees and birds and buildings, as also in many other things. But all things here lack crude matter. H. J. L. But do their evil thoughts here influence others to evil? He. When on earth did you never notice that to men, or even more, each working independently, even separated from each other by thousands of miles, at the same moment make the same discovery? H. J. L. Yes, often, but put it down to coincidence. He. There is no such thing as coincidence. That word is merely a cloak employed by men to disguise the fact that they are ignorant of some of the fundamental laws of God. Again, have you never seen how an idea can continue for ages to influence mankind, though all who knew its origin have passed away? Have you never seen how such an idea, though forgotten in its original home, Will yet reappear somewhere else without any known connection having taken place? Gone West, H. J. L. Then, once created, a thought may go on creating fresh thoughts? He. Yes, but only such as relate to it. It could not create a fresh thought on an entirely different subject. H. J. L. But a man can. Why, then, is it different? He may at one time create a cruel thought which will go on influencing others to do cruel deeds, yet at the next moment he may create a thought of kindness which others will develop into much that is good. Why this difference? He. Of what does a man consist? H. J. L. Matter, form, force. He. Of what does a thought, once created, consist? H. J. L. I suppose form only. He. You are answered. H. J. L. Ah, then it is the presence of what you call force. What is force? He. Some say force is God, and some that force and matter are God, and some that force and matter are the same, and it is this that is God. Can man create either? H. J. L. I suppose he creates only forms. He. Are you not, then, answered? H. J. L. I don't see quite how it answers my original question, namely, why we can create variant thoughts when our own thoughts cannot. He. God creates you, you create your thought influences others. Your thought's action is bounded by the thought that created it, your actions are bounded by the force which actuates you. God is bounded by nothing. H. J. L. I see it all. I cannot think about that of which I have no knowledge. But God is knowledge. He. God is all in all. You have learnt your first lessons. Now go for recreation, all of you. Next moment we were outside like boys running out from school, and we amuse ourselves in many various ways. But our pleasures here are mental. What was our work on earth is our amusement here. I very naturally drifted into the set who were interested in architecture. They varied in size, or, really, in spiritual development. Many were in the upper forms of the school, and one of these suggested we should go off to see some of the famous buildings which had at one time existed. I don't want to see any of the hideous villas which disfigure most of our suburbs, I remarked. Such as one of those you built, eh? Remarked a boy whom I recognized as a man I knew slightly on earth. I should have felt annoyed on earth. But here I only chuckled. The big boy who had suggested the expedition answered, "Oh, you need not fear that. All that is hideous goes to hell. We don't get the finest work here, of course, that goes to the people in the sets above us. Still, all our stuff is good. There are some very fine Assyrian buildings we might go and see. Do all the buildings come here, or only those which have perished?" I asked. If a building is practically untouched it does not come here, but if it is partly destroyed and rebuilt, the whole of the original form comes here. You see, the alterations have given it a new form which may in due course also come here. That's part of the interest of it. You can see how the Tower of London has changed from century to century. Of course we don't have its exact present form. So we went off to see the Assyrian buildings, and I enjoyed it immensely. J. W. As you are in with architects, do you ever come across a man called A? H. J. L. It's funny you should inquire about him, for he was the man who made that remark about the houses. Gone West, J. W. About those you built? H. J. L. Yes. J. W. How is he getting on? H. J. L. He's in our set. He told me he was fearfully annoyed when he found he was with those who only half believed. He said to his teacher, "But I did believe," his guide replied, "Had you really believed, you would not be here. Like many others, you thought you believed. But belief does not consist of merely saying I believe. You must truly grasp it. Had you really believed, you could not have lived the life you did. Plenty of people who thought they believed find themselves in hell. A man's belief must be shown forth in his life, or it is not real. This does not mean that a man who believes may not commit many grievous sins. He may. nor yet does it mean that he will not suffer for them. We are responsible for every thought and act, but still, belief must be real before it counts. There is no deceiving anyone, not even one's own self, here. You half believed, and are, therefore, in this part. Had you not believed at all, you would be in hell. Now go and make progress. J.W. is he? H.J.L. Not very fast. You see, he was younger, and almost all his interests were physical sports, good wine, women, and business. He died in the midst of them, and the earth pull is very strong. He is not earthbound, no one here is, but still he does hanker after the earth. Why, he often plays truant and goes back to his old haunts and friends on earth. It's not with the same desires as the earthbound go, hoping to be able to enjoy their old lusts, but with a kind of affection for old friends and places. I am really very sorry, for it throws him back terribly, and he's a very nice fellow. However, as he himself says, he died 30 years at least before his time, and I suppose he's got to spend that time before he'll be in the same position as those who died after their 70th birthday. He told that to the master one day when he reprimanded him for playing truant. He's fearfully slow in class, can't grasp quite simple things, although he died so much earlier than I did, I've passed him already. But he's a jolly fellow, very popular out of school. He misses his games, though, terribly. He's got a vein of humor. He explained the other day that he prayed fervently that his wife might not die for many years, as he was afraid she would rout him out here. Now you have heard quite enough, or you'll want to stick here altogether. We then began to walk back towards the avenue. Reaching there, we sat down, and I seemed to fall asleep. J. W. Gone West, Chapter 11, He Attends His Own Funeral, 9th Letter of H. J. L. At home, Glen House, February 21, 7 p.m., after I had apparently been attending the school for a long time, my guide kindly to me one day and said, "It is time for you to go to your funeral." "My funeral?" I cried. "I thought that had taken place ages ago." "Oh no," he replied, "you have, according to our reckoning, been here quite a long time. But, according to Earth time, you have only been here 3 days." This was the first time I realized the huge difference between our method of reckoning time, or rather, our escape from time, and your subservience to it. In those 3 earthly days I had made apparently many months' progress, had learnt much about spiritual things, and had seen numerous fine buildings of ancient days. At this point I should add that here there is nothing comparable to night and day, nor is there any sleep. This is, of course, evident if you think for a moment, for the spirit never sleeps even upon earth. It, unlike the body, needs no rest. Well, my guide told my master where I was going, and I was excused lessons. We were just going to begin work. I expect this sounds rather funny to you. Next moment we were at LD, there was no long journey through the ether, as I imagined would be the case. Simply I found myself in my old bedroom. Of course it is now plainer to me. Our world and yours are not separated by anything akin to space. One might almost say they are both in the same space. But there, it is impossible to make this point quite plain to you, I fear. I, of course, noticed that the room was changed and the furniture out of its proper place, and then I noticed the coffin. It was covered by a large white sheet, but I could see through this, and perceived my body lying there. Strangely enough, it did not seem to have the attraction for me which I expected it would. I looked at it more as one might look at a marble sculpture than as at an old friend. "You have finished your work and your day is done, old friend," I murmured. Even as I thought this, another thought welled up. Were you really a friend or only a taskmaster? Now at any rate I was free, and I rejoiced. After a while I felt I should like to see what the others were doing. Next moment I was in the dining room. It was so full that, to avoid touching the others, I stood in, or, rather, through the middle of the table. Of course it did not interfere with me in any way, nor, indeed, would their bodies. But yet some instinct, probably inherited from my earthly state, compelled me to avoid running into them. I saw them all, U, G, D, M, and Miss P. There did not seem to be much to learn there, so I drifted into the drawing room, where my wife was, but soon drifted out. To tell the truth, I rather felt as if I was in the way, and wondered vaguely why I had been taken from school, where I was every day learning something new and interesting, to see these vacuities. My guide answered, "At the moment of burial the spirit always feels an inarticulate yearning to see its earthly shell and bid it farewell. There is a good reason for this, indeed, several. Besides the mere earthly attachment which all men feel for their bodies, akin to that usually felt by a dog for its master, even when that master was often cruel to it, there are the following. At burials there are usually certain evil beings who hang round the corpse, hoping against hope, they know not always how, to draw some carnal satisfaction from the corpse, some touch of earthly lusts which still haunt it. Gone west, occasionally, under exceptional circumstances, they may try, and even succeed, in drawing a kind of material body from the dead corpse by means of which to clothe their naked souls. This can only happen in the case of men who have lived evil lives. From this shame you are free, nevertheless, you and I go to see that nothing of evil shall approach what once held you. Further, it is right that you should follow to its last resting place a friend with whom you have been associated for so long. Finally, by showing you the pettiness of the life you have left, to make you the more rejoice in that in which you now are." After this I again returned and sat by my corpse, and presently you entered. I saw you remove the napkin and look at my face, but all the time I was standing opposite to you. I saw, rather to my surprise, how distressed you were, and tried to attract your attention, saying, "I am all right. Don't you see me?" Once I thought you heard me, for you looked straight in my face for a moment, but you did not. Then, replacing the napkin and sheet, you turned and left the room. Soon after, the undertaker's men entered, and, having screwed down the lid, took the coffin downstairs. I went with the procession to the church. After the coffin had been lowered into the grave and you had all gone, I did not follow you, but waited by the grave till it was filled in. This completed, I looked at the marble statue which had once held me. I could, of course, see through the earth perfectly well, and then, turning to my guide, said, "Shall we now be going?" The thought had hardly been formed when, lo, I was back in the school again, and oh, with what a sigh of relief. I looked round for my guide, but he had gone. But by now I had become accustomed to his strange comings and goings. "Take your place," said my master kindly. "We have only had one round of questions." Only one round, I thought, yet I was on earth for hours. Indeed, there is no relation between time there and here. My master seemed to divine my thoughts, for he answered at once, "You ought to know by now that here there is no such thing as time." I suppose it was having been back to earth that now made me feel just the least surprised at his answering a thought of mine. I again looked at the boys, and now realized for the first time how small and immature were the mortals whom I had just seen. These, at any rate, were boys, but they, for the most part, were the merest babes, some hardly born. I realized in particular, with mild surprise, how infantile was the spirit in Dash, and in. Yet though both were babes, there was some indescribable difference between them. When I saw you all, I saw your spiritual bodies through a grey sort of shadow, your earthly bodies, and often the largest and finest shadow bodies had the smallest and most misshapen and infantile spirit bodies. How glad I was to be back at school, back in the realities of life. Away from all pettiness and futilities of what you call life on earth, but at the same time a new desire had come upon me, and that was to let you and others know this fact. Rest half an hour. H. J. L. Gone West, Chapter 12, He Goes to College. H. J. L. S. 10th Letter. Glen House, 8:50 p.m., February 21, 1914. To resume my narrative. After returning to school I felt strongly that I wanted to tell those I had seen what the real conditions over here were like, partly because I saw one or two were grieving rather, but more because they all either did not believe in a future life at all, or else had evidently wrong ideas as to what it was like over here. I have already told you of my fruitless endeavors to reach other members of the family, and how at length I got in touch with you. Now I will explain how I learned that one could tell those still living. No sooner had the idea come to me than my guide entered the classroom. "Your pupil has learned his lesson so well," he said to our master, "that he can now leave school. He will go to a university instead." "He has made splendid progress," said my master. "Good, go forward, my lad." Class was then dismissed, and all the other boys crowded round me. "You have shot up," they said. "Why, you are nearly a man." Several others, I noticed, were also speaking to their guides, and it was quite a batch of us who said farewell to the building which had now become so familiar to us all. My guide then began to speak. "You wish to communicate with those still living?" "Why?" I said, "to tell them of this life, so that they may try and prepare themselves for it, so that they need not go through the elementary lessons which I had to learn." "Many, too, who believe in a future life have no real idea as to what it is like, but why should you wish to speak to them? They will all come to us someday, and then they will have to learn." "Yes, but on earth I neglected these things, and now would make some little amends." "This is a good reason, and truly they do need much light, and by helping them you will help yourself. Lo, you are now in the second instead of the first stage of this realm or set." "How can I do it?" I said. "That you must find out for yourself. We tell nothing here. Each soul must strive to answer his own questions, and if he really strives he will succeed." Soon I found myself without my guide among a crowd of young men. We seemed to be in some university town. Several of the men drifted towards me, and, without the usual hesitation which I should have felt on earth, I asked what I could do to tell those on earth of this life. One of them replied, "We, too, are trying to find out how to do that very thing. Come with us." We now searched throughout that large town, and at last found what we sought. Let me say here that the dominant note of the place was the desire to help others who were already dead. At length we found a lecturer, as he would have been called on earth. But he did not lecture, but asked us questions, as the master had done. When we said, "How can we tell those still living?" he replied, "How do you do anything here?" "By thinking about it," you are answered. "We think then," I said, "that we wish to communicate with the living. Gone west, naturally, how otherwise? And do we think of one person or many?" "Which you please, but which is easier, to think of one person or many persons?" "One," we all cried together. "Are there any other questions?" he asked. We had none then, so we went together to a sort of private study and there all concentrated our thoughts on this great matter. It sounds very simple to say think of something, but in practice we found it terribly hard to concentrate on one sole thought. Other ideas would come floating in. We seemed to try this for weeks and weeks, but at length one man did get through. This encouraged us. Another who had been trying for some time said, "I wonder if the man I am thinking about is not receptive." This started a long discussion, and we all agreed that probably it would be easier to get in touch with those who were not dematerialistic. So, as we could not always tell who were the most materialistic, we decided to make such a list, and work through them by degrees. You know the rest. At length I got you. That night I seemed specially drawn towards Earth, I think now because it was just a week since I had died. I gradually became aware of the fact that I was drawing closer to you than I had yet done to the others, but it was not till you went to bed that I really got in touch with you. This taught me how to work, and, once started, things went easier. Finally, I met P, who told me how to try automatic writing. Yours, H. J. L. Gone West, Chapter 13, Animals on the Spirit Plane. Transvision or conversation during night of February 23rd, I, J. W., found myself seated by the edge of a beautiful lake. It reminded me at one time of Coniston, but next moment it seemed more like Lake Lucerne. H. J. L. was by me. "Do you," I said, "have houses to live in?" "Yes, he replied. I at present am living in college. Is it like any college which still exists? I think, he replied, that it is Old Queen's College, Oxford, which was pulled down to make way for the present classical building. J. W.